You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 10 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.
This is Jacqueline Keeler, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of American Standoff. And we're a KBOO FM Portland show that examines the current political divide in America from an Indigenous perspective, given by myself, Jacqueline Keeler. I'm a Native journalist based here in Oregon. Over a year ago, on January 6, 2021, thousands of supporters of former President Trump gathered in D.C. and later stormed the Capitol, contesting President Biden's election. They're pushing the big lie, the idea that the election had been stolen. And, of course, as I mentioned, every time that we had the same thing happen here in Oregon, at Salem, our Capitol was stormed just 2 weeks before, on December 21st, 2020, and although over COVID restrictions. So today on American Standoff, we're taking a look at the startling testimony given by former Oath Keepers spokesperson Jason Van Totenhove to the January 6th committee on Tuesday of this week. And we're going to be also examining the connections to the Bundy family standoff way back in 2014. And as many of you know, my book, Standoff, it really looks at and examines sort of the Bundy family, their ideology, and contrasts the treatment of their armed standoff against the federal government to that at Standing Rock, of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe fighting against the building of a pipeline through their territory and endangering the water sources for their communities. And so that, of course, was an unarmed standoff in Standing Rock. And so and I covered both of these as a journalist in 2016. January 2016, I was covering the Malheur Wildlife Refuge takeover. I did cover Clive and Bundy's takeover at Bunkerville, Nevada in 2014 in The Nation. I did an article actually contrasting the perspective of Clive and Bundy and his idea of his ancestral rights to land of the in Nevada, of which, of course, Native nations, notably the Paiute and the Shoshone, have far earlier claims to the land that he occupies and uses, and contrasting his form of organizing with these armed militias, and the sort of sense of that he's right and he has a right to everything that he wants because he knows best, to that of what was happening in the organizing against the Keystone XL pipeline in South Dakota and Nebraska, and really looking at the way in which joined by concern for the land itself, white farmers and ranchers in Nebraska and South Dakota were working in concert with tribes to protect the land and to prevent the pipeline from being built. So in that article in The Nation, which came out, I think, April of 2014, I did contrast that. And then, of course, I ended 2016 covering the standoff at Standing Rock as well. And so so we are going to really look at how this recent hearing and the testimony given by Mr. Van Totenhove has really sort of how that plays into all this and the sort of what I really look at is I look at origin stories. What are the origin stories of a people, and what is the difference between colonial origin stories and Indigenous origin stories, and how they differ and what they make a people be and what they make a people do. What are the outcomes of these stories? And I like to refer to origin stories as a set of algorithms or even a function, sort of how they then percolate out into the future and how they impact the entire world. If you look at issues like climate change and nuclear winter. So today we're examining the connections between the Bundy standoff starting 8 years ago in Bunkerville, Nevada, and the violence of the Capitol insurrection on January 6, 2021, which, according to Mr. Van Totenhove, could have unleashed far more bloodshed. So, as I mentioned on the show, we examine the connections between, its origins in white supremacy, the DNA of colonialism, and the ongoing occupation of indigenous homelands in the United States. And so, once again, my name is Jacqueline Keeler, and I'm your host, and this is a call-in show, so please feel free to call in. The number is 503-231-8181. At 8187. And if you watch the testimony, let me know what you thought. How did you feel about what Mr. Van Totenhove said, and also Mr. Stephen Ayers, who is a former Trump supporter who participated and was pled guilty to invading the Capitol. So we discussed these connections between militia groups that support armed rebellion in the West, particularly the standoffs led by the Bundy family and tied to opposition to the Bureau of Land Management and at Malheur oversight by federal agencies like the Fish and Wildlife Service. So who is Jason Van Totenhove, right? He is a former spokesman for the Oath Keepers, a militia group, an armed militia group, and he left the group several years ago and has been speaking out against it about the dangers it presents. So he has claimed that far-right extremist militia wanted January 6th to become, quote, an armed revolution. The Oath Keepers were founded in 2009 by a former armored paratrooper, Rhodes, by Stuart Rhodes, and according to Van Totenhove, Rhodes has become increasingly more radical in the months and years leading up to the Capitol attack. There are also allegations that Mr. Rhodes used conspiracy theories to raise money for the group and to increase its membership. So let's listen to a brief snippet of Van Totenhove's testimony as he is being questioned by Representative Jamie Raskin.
He implored President Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act, the 1807 law that allows the president to call up militias to put down a rebellion. What did he think it would enable the Oath Keepers to do?
Well, I think it gave him a sense of legitimacy, that it was a path forward to move forward with his goals and agendas. I think we need to quit mincing words and just talk about truths. And what it was going to be was an armed revolution. I mean, people died that day. Law enforcement officers died this day. There was a gallows set up in front of the Capitol. This could have been the spark that started a new civil war, and no one would have won there. That would have been good for no one. He was always looking for ways to legitimize what he was doing, whether by wrapping it in the trappings of it's not a militia, it's a community preparedness team. We're not a militia, we're an educational outreach group. It's a veteran support group. But again, we've got to stop with this dishonesty and the mincing of words and just call things for what they are. You know, he's a militia leader. He had these grand visions of being a paramilitary leader, and the Insurrection Act would have given him a path forward with that.
So that was a brief snippet of testimony given by Jason Van Totenhove, a former spokesperson for the Oath Keepers, to the House Select Committee on January 6th. And so good morning once again. This is American Standoff. We are a live talk radio show, so please do call in if you want to be part of this conversation. The number here is 503-231-8187, and I'm Jacqueline Keeler, your host. And so I always like to welcome you all again in my own language. And so in the Navajo way, we also introduce ourselves to our clans. My clan is Kia'ani Nishle, and I am board for the Yankton Sioux people, the Ihonktawan Dakota people. And so I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation. My mother is Navajo, and my father is Yankton Dakota Sioux. And so I'd also like to acknowledge that what we now call Portland, Oregon, is on the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Wasco, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Cowlitz bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kayapuya, Malala, and many other tribes. And the question I ask every episode, and I'll ask it again now, is in the more than the year that has passed, year and a half now, since January 6, 2021, when we all saw the Capitol stormed, the Capitol of the United States, what have we learned? This week, we learned some more about the extent of the violence planned and what could have happened. We opened with a brief snippet at the top of the show of Jason Van Totenhoek's testimony on Tuesday before the House Select Committee on January 6th. Mr. Totenhoek began to work with the Oath Keepers around 2014. He went to cover the Bunkerville standoff that Clive and Bundy led in Nevada in 2014. And eventually he became the public face of the group during several prominent anti-government and militia operations. He issued statements for the organization, answered questions from the media, and particularly after Mr. Rhodes and his men helped support Clive and Bundy, the Scufflaw rancher, who conducted an armed standoff with federal agents in Nevada who were attempting to round up his cattle that were illegally grazing on public lands for over 20 years, and he had racked up $1 million in fines. And although Mr. Bundy does not recognize the federal government as having the right to do these things, and which I go into much more depth in my book, Standoff. Mr. Van Totenhoek was also involved in the Oath Keepers media operation when the group deployed as self-appointed vigilantes to Ferguson, Missouri, after protests broke out over the death of Michael Brown, a young black man killed by the police. And of course, this was the origins of the Black Lives Movement as we know it. And Mr. Van Totenhoek and the Oath Keepers were there to protect the business owners. Yeah, they were not on the right side of that one. And so since leading the Oath Keepers, Mr. Van Totenhoek has occasionally spoken out about the threatening nature of the group. So he is quoted as having said, he was quoted by the Denver Post in February, "I have these self-realization moments where I'm like, I help these guys out, I help spread the message, and yeah, it was just with words, but I've got to try to do something to try and make up for that part of my life, for that in my life." So let's listen to more of Mr. Totenhoek's testimony before the January 6th committee. Here he's being introduced by Representative Benny Thompson, the chair of the committee.
Ken, thank you. My time with the Oath Keepers began back at Bundy Ranch with that first standoff when I went to cover them as an independent journalist. I then subsequently covered two more standoffs, the Sugar Pine Mine standoff and the White Hope Mine standoff. It was at that time that I was offered a job as national media director and an associate editor for the webpage. So I spent a few years with the Oath Keepers, and I can tell you that they may not like to call themselves a militia, but they are. They're a violent militia, and they are largely Stuart Rhodes. I think rather than try to use words, I think the best illustration for what the Oath Keepers are happened January 6th, when we saw that stacked military formation going up the stairs of our Capitol. I saw radicalization that started with my beginning of my time with them and continued over a period of time as the member base and who it was that Stuart Rhodes was courting drifted further and further right into the alt-right world, into white nationalists, and even straight up racists. And it came to a point where I could no longer continue to work for them. But the Oath Keepers are a dangerous militia that is in large part fed by the ego and drive of Stuart Rhodes, who at times seemed to see himself as this paramilitary leader. I think that drove a lot of it. So in my opinion, the Oath Keepers are a very dangerous organization.
Well, thank you very much. You've talked a little bit about that danger. So what is the Oath Keepers' vision for America, and why should Americans be concerned about it?
I think we saw a glimpse of what the vision of the Oath Keepers is on January 6th. It doesn't necessarily include the rule of law. It doesn't necessarily include, it includes violence. It includes trying to get their way through lies, through deceit, through intimidation, and through the perpetration of violence. The swaying of people who may not know better through lies and rhetoric and propaganda that can get swept up in these moments. And I'll admit, I was swept up at one point as well, too. But I don't know if that answers the question.
Well, it does. And you talk about being swept up. So at what point did you break with the Oath Keepers?
There came a point. There were many red flags, and I probably should have broke with them much earlier than I did. But the straw that broke the camel's back really came when I walked into a grocery store. We were living up in the very remote town of Eureka, Montana, and there was a group of core members of the group, of the Oath Keepers, and some associates, and they were having a conversation at that public area where they were talking about how the Holocaust was not real. And that was, for me, something I just could not abide. And, you know, we were not wealthy people at all. We were barely surviving, and it didn't matter. I went home to my wife and my kids, and I told them that I've got to walk away at this point. I don't know how we're going to survive or where we're going to go or what we're going to do, but I just can no longer continue and put in my resignation.
Thank you very much.
So there we just heard more testimony from Jason Van Totenhove, the former Oath Keeper spokesperson, who testified before the January 6th committee on Tuesday. This is American Standoff. Once again, we're a live talk radio show. So please feel free to call in if you want to be part of this conversation. How did you feel when you heard the testimony on Tuesday, and how do you feel about the role that that Oregon plays in the sort of the rise of the right-wing militias? The number here is 503-231-8187. And you heard him mention the Sugar Pine Mine, which was another standoff that happened in Oregon. And it started around 2015. And it was basically a small mining dispute in Oregon, which then reached out to a network of militias that had been at the Malheur occupation, and it sort of turned into an armed standoff as well here in Oregon. And the two men behind the Sugar Pine Mine were George Bax and Rick Barclay, and they have a claim to a mine in southern Oregon, a gold mine that dates back to 1876. And so it's not under the regulations of the 1955 Surface Resources Act. So they claim that the Bureau of Land Management couldn't prevent them from construction work necessary to work their claim. And this land sits actually near the headwaters of the Rogue River. And so, but because the mine is on public land, the BLM says the men still have to get their construction plans approved ahead of time, which they did not do. And so in March 2015, the BLM issued two notices of noncompliance to the men, and then Bax and Barclay filed a notice of appeal, and they also asked for help from local members of the Josephine County Oath Keepers, which is a militia group that had participated in the standoff in 2014 at Bunkerville, and then with Cliven Bundy, the father of Ammon Bundy, who led the armed takeover at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in 2016. And so they got a collection of armed men, just like what happened in Bunkerville, and they forced the Bureau of Land Management to back down. That was in Nevada, actually. So the Sugar Pine Mine standoff in 2015, they got the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters, members of the Pacific Patriots Network, and these were all groups that went on to participate in the 2016 standoff at Malheur the following year. And so several hundred self-described patriots, many heavily armed, patrolled the mining claim for weeks. And they had the pocket constitutions, which I go into a great deal of description in my book about how those Skousen constitutions were developed by a founder of the the Birch Society, John Birch Society, and also a Mormon leader. And so they are still mining as of a report from 2021, so February 2020, this last year. So but that is something that also happened here in Oregon, and really points to the ways in which, you know, our state has been sort of particularly in places like Josephine County, have been sort of breeding grounds for a lot of this violence that we're seeing, that's actually impacting the national level and threatening democracy itself. So I don't think that's an overstatement. If you disagree with me, please do call in and let me know and how you feel about that. I saw that a poll came out recently that found that 30% of Americans, their top three issues going into the elections of 2022 are, one of them is the threats to democracy that are happening, which I think we can really credit to the hearings that have really made it much more clear to Americans what happened and the scope of the problem, and also gun violence, which tragically has also been brought to our brought to the public consciousness in really tragic events. And the third one is, of course, Roe v. Wade. And three very really crucial elements of the civil society that are presently under threat. I wanted to bring this back to 2014, right?
We have a caller.
We have a caller. Okay.
David.
Caller? Hi, David. You're on American Standoff.
Yeah, morning. This is the first time I've heard your particular show, so seems like a good start. I am kind of concerned with how these militia types are basically being tricked into believing opposite to their own logic. For example, if you're familiar with William Jennings Bryan of 100 years ago, he was talking about how the banks were basically killing the farmers and killing the, you know, the adherents of the current, red state, let's say, were big fans of William Jennings Bryan, who was decrying the idea of the banks limiting the money supply and using gold to crush the emerging American Republic. And when I found out that the Bundys took over that area up in Oregon, I quickly looked at a mineral map, and they were basically going for the gold. That used to be an area that there were gold mines in. And so today, in the news today, the right-wing media and Fox News are ranting about how Biden is printing too much money. Well, in the famous old days, William Jennings Bryan, and long before that, they would print 10 times more paper than there was gold in the treasury. And William Jennings Bryan was complaining and decrying the fact that the bankers were limiting the amount of money down to six times or down to eight times, and that there was so little cash out in the circulation that the average person didn't have the cash to be able to do all of the things that were necessary in a small town or a county. And that they needed to increase the money supply up to 10 times. And so when you start looking at the idea that America finally got rid of gold as a treasury necessity, that we were going to use intellectualism and education as a means of exchange, and that the money supply is based upon how smart and intelligent and future thinking the world is, that we can print paper enough to deal with all of the inventions and all of the creativity and all of the forward movement that we need. So it's funny how the Bundys and these militia types are trying to drag us back to a gold standard, which was never sufficient enough. You know, there's not tonnage enough of gold to be able to deal with all of the projects that the world needs to deal with. And to drag us back to an era like that is to drag us back into, you know, the company store or the boss man on the hill that just orders everybody around. So I'm just wondering if you've looked at that idea.
Yeah, well, the rise of currency has a lot of elements to it. I think in this case, what I really examine when I'm examining these sorts of what we've seen happening with the rise of militia groups and these sorts of right-wing groups is the use of what I really see it like when I talk about it being related to origin stories, right? Origin stories of a people, right? We're very familiar with the idea of origin stories for Native people, right? How a Native people believe they came to a place and how this determines who they are. And in my book, Stand Up, I contrast these origin stories a lot. Right. My definition for an indigenous origin story is based in a definition given by my grandmother's cousin, the Lakota historian from Standing Rock, Vine Deloria Jr., where he said that an indigenous origin story is based in when a people have a meeting with a sacred being who is a manifestation of the land itself. Right. And in this meeting, agreements are made. And when we make these agreements with the land, right, then we become a people. And we were something else before that agreement was made. But then once we made the agreement with the land, and it's a specific area, you know, for my mother's people, for the Diné people, it's between the four sacred mountains and the four sacred rivers. And this is the Diné Ta, the Diné Pekeya. And once we made this agreement with the holy people, then we became Diné. We became the five-fingered people. And once we accepted the pollen path, then we became these people, right? And it defines us on every level, every decision we make. And therefore, that's why I compare these origin stories to algorithms that create outcomes, right? When you're looking at the origin story, and I really think that the two pieces that tie these two differing responses together to the gold standard and to currency is really the origin story of a colonial people, right? What do a colonial people need, right? And or want, right? And as colonists. And so in my book, I make it very clear that I see the Bundys, and you know, the Bundys did try to come to Standing Rock and try to claim that they were standing for the same thing as the Native people there, as with the Lakota people, the Dakota and Lakota people. But that is not true, because as the Dakota and Lakota people, our ties are not to a colonial enterprise, right? But our ties are to the land, and defined by our relationship, my father's people's relationship to the white buffalo cattlemen. You know, when we came and to the Great Plains, and we made an agreement with the white, she came to us, the white buffalo cattlemen. She was a representation of the Great Plains, right? And she came smoking the pipe, the chongpa, and which had in it the leg bone of a buffalo, right? A bison. And when we smoked that pipe, we made that agreement not just with her, but also with the Buffalo Nation, the Tatakaliatewa, you know, the buffalo people, the bison people. And at that point, we became part of the land. And so, but the colonial people, their agreements are not with the land. They get land, they own land, right? According to the Doctrine of Discovery, issued by the Supreme Court, Native nations cannot own land. We are like the animals. We have only the rights of occupancy and use. And this was reaffirmed as recently as 2005 in a ruling written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, right? And so we are not human, in a sense, fully human. And so, but with colonists, they do have ownership of land. Although in this case with the Bundys and stuff, they only owned 160 acres, and the rest of the land they were using was public land, which they were claiming a right to because their horses had nibbled a little bit of grass and the waters flowed and the place turned into this paradise because of their use of the land. This is their claim. So when you're looking at what colonial people are asking from decade to decade, right, even separated by 100 years, it changes based on their situation. But it's always about their colonial rights as colonists to prosper, right? What was promised in the Constitution, or so what you're looking at with the gold standard, that is just they were reacting to very different factors that would allow them to develop their land. And I put that in quotation marks, right? And so. What people on the frontier, I mean, this was a frontier issue for a long time, even back in the early 1800s. I mean, I went to Dartmouth College, and one of our first he didn't graduate, he left Dartmouth, but his father was a dean of Dartmouth, and he in the 1700s, right, late 1700s, he had a bestseller book because he was a counterfeiter, and counterfeiters were regarded as sort of heroes to the people living on the frontier who did not have access to paper money. And so, of course, you had to have a certain amount of money to be a counterfeiter in education, because you had to be able to afford a printing press. You had to be able to make the fake plates and everything. At the time, the money was not being printed by the federal government. The money was being printed by individual banks. And so this Dartmouth guy went up to Canada. He was, printing fake counterfeit notes from banks in Massachusetts and places like that, and then flooding them into the frontier where they didn't have access to money, they didn't have access to roads. I mean, some of those, if you hear some of how people on the frontier white people were doing on the frontier, colonists, they were living in rags. They were often described as being worse off than Native people because they didn't know how to do the things that Native people could do or have access to the trading routes that Native people had. So they couldn't bring their stuff to market. They were living literally like very in primitive state, and a very pitiful state. And so, you might have your land, but if you have no way to do anything, it's almost useless. And actually, the Bundys themselves, they didn't move west until around 1900 from Indiana, but they got land in the Arizona Strip, and they abandoned it. They got free land. They lived there until the mid 20th century. They finally just abandoned it. Sometimes if the land is not, even if you have title, through homesteading, it's worthless if you can't actually make a living there, right, and support yourself. And so I think that you're looking at, what you're seeing now with the rural population, particularly since, the Sagebrush Rebellion that's been ongoing since the 70s, and was really a reaction to a lot of the change in the sort of grazing rights issues and stuff in the West, where before there was no need to, everything was open, you could go and graze all you wanted, and you didn't have any oversight at all. So it's just changing elements of sort of what they're confronted with their rights as colonists. And I think that is the tying thing. The U.S. dollar has definitely changed. I mean, I think that the federal government didn't start printing money until around World War One, right? And then by World War II, they took, there's some really, a really great podcast about the Bretton Woods Agreement, which followed World War II. And delegates from allied countries met in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, and they came up with a system to manage foreign exchange. And this is when the dollar was they decided that the currencies would no longer be linked to gold, but would be pegged to a U.S. dollar. And that's how our currency basically became gold. The gold became what it took the place of gold internationally, and this is what's really led to a lot of the U.S.'s power in the world financial markets. So there is a lot of history there, but I think the sort of the tie between the two is definitely the colonial origin story. What is a colonist, right? A colonist is someone who goes to other people's homeland, other people's countries, occupies them, and takes their wealth and exports it to their ruling class. That's the definition of a colony, right? And
well, that's
so,
a good answer. It's a good answer, and you know, it's interesting. With global warming, we're going to end up with more refugees, which in some ways is going to be defined as a colonist. And so the problems, if we don't resolve some of these problems today, you know, in other words, get the help these poor saps get their story straight, the climate change refugees are just going to be encroaching on the last green lands.
Well,
so,
I definitely don't call Black Americans colonists, right? I don't think they fit that. But the big issue is, what role do you play in the system where you live, right? Are you part of an indigenous community? Are you living with an indigenous community? Are you in active sort of, opposition to a colonial occupation? And so these are sort of the definitions of what are you about? What are you doing? You know, and so, as far as these guys getting their story right, they're actually not that interested in getting their story right. This is the point of a lot of the testimony, is that it's a use of narrative to access the leaders of power to get what they want. So they don't necessarily care about that, as long as they can actually, they want to destabilize things enough through violence and mayhem, and then be able to do a power grab. And this has been a very effective thing for most of human history. In my book, I look back to the invasion of England, right, in 1066 by William the Conqueror from Normandy. And one of the astounding things I found in my research, because I really examined Anglo-Saxon common law, which a lot of U.S. law is based in, but also which the Bundys, particularly Clive and Bundy, references continuously in old Anglo-Saxon law, right? You know, the commons, all these things. And they have the idea of the sheriff being the most powerful person in the world within the boundaries of the county, right? County supremacy ideology, which is a key part of their kind of narrative of power grabbing, and which is then says that, you know, the sheriff was an old Anglo-Saxon elected official, and therefore within the boundaries of the county, he is the most powerful, he or she is the most powerful person in the world, more powerful than the president of the United States, the governor of the state legislature, any agencies. You know, the sheriff is the one. That's why they're always turning to the sheriff, right? They're trying to get the sheriff to do these things for them, because they believe within old Anglo-Saxon belief that, you know, legal systems, that he or she is the one that can basically do anything, right? And so so I really looked at old Anglo-Saxon common law, which I found that the sheriff is not that at all. That's completely incorrect. But they don't care about facts, right? They care about narratives,
right.
Narratives that give them access to power. And so, it's just, you know, what happened with 1066 was William the Conqueror succeeded in a violent invasion of, he murdered 90% of the Anglo-Saxon nobles, right? Only 10% were left who had marriageable daughters and stuff. He handed out all the land to his followers, to his friends, and to this day, in 2019, a book came out that found that that him and his friends and their descendants still own 70% of England, right? And so, when you violently overtake something, you are able to, and you put in a structure, right, a power structure, that you are able to hold on to things. You know what I mean? So they don't care about truth or facts. They care about power grabs that are enabled by narratives that give them access to the levers of power.
I don't doubt that. Just two things to wrap up. I was going to, Robin Hood, of course, was going against some of that power grab, and he was working on the concept of the social contract, that the leaders, the kings or whatever, sheriffs or whatnot, in his case, to the evil sheriff of Nottingham, that those guys were out, they were not looking out for every sparrow that falls. The king pretended he was put in charge by God, and he was supposed to look out for everybody, but he was just looking out for himself. So the guy like Robin Hood was trying to work with the social contract, which called those power grabbers phonies. And the second thing I was going to raise, I'm wondering if you've run into apparently in China, they've tried to reclaim a lot of the desolate land.
I have an audio I really need to share. It's going to be a long one. So,
oh, sure. Well, I'll just give you the phrase, the Loess Plateau, L-O-E-S-S Plateau. Okay. It's in China, and it's they've reclaimed some horribly blistered land. And if we're going to end up with refugees and colonists from global warming, this Loess Plateau...
I wouldn't call refugees colonists. I think that they... but anyway, we'll get into... That's another topic. We need to... I have some more I have to introduce for this particular topic on this show. So thank you so much, David. I really appreciate it. So, okay, all right. Let's play the next audio piece I have, which is a longer piece, and I apologize. It has some background noise caused by the wind, but it becomes clear towards the audio becomes clear towards the end. This is of a 2014 press conference given by Oath Keepers leader Stuart Rhodes during the Bunkerville standoff in 2014, and it gives some perspective, and the quotes are really interesting. So let's try playing that now.
When Sheriff Mack and I first heard about this, our first stop was to call Matt Shea, Washington State legislator, a stand-up patriot, and his first idea was to get as many legislators here as possible. And so he started right away to gather folks from the West. And he's got some folks. We got Matt Shea right here. We got a fellow legislator right here from Washington State. We got folks from Montana. This is a Western issue. This is an attack on the entire West. And it's an attack to stamp out your culture and to crush you economically so that you can no longer be independent Americans. Powers that be fear independent Americans. And so they want you to bend the knee. What we saw just the other day when Ammon Bundy was being tased and his head thrown to the ground, did they bend the knee?
No,
they got right back up. She got right back up off the ground with skinned knees and got right back in their face. And I told her, on Saturday, Sheriff Mack and I had the privilege and honor of watching this family and the Cowboys stand once again. It was like watching an old Western with a posse settle up and rides, and the rustlers hightail it over the horizon. But after it was over, I told her, I said, you know what made the difference? What made the difference, I believe, was the fact that it was the Bundy women standing in their faces, showing no fear. That shamed the men across America to get off the couch and saddle up and join them here. The women led the way. The courage of those Bundy women behind their men led the way and showed the example. Just like Michelle Fiore. She had five other legislators who were supposed to be here today from Nevada. Your representatives, where are they?
Yeah, right.
She's the only one that showed up. So why did, I guess the women have to show the men how it's done around here. This is my good buddy, Steve Holman from Nebraska, the Vietnam Combat Vet Marine. He came down here from Nebraska to be with you today. And when he got here, he got a phone call from a lady, Lori from Nebraska, up in cattle country in Nebraska. And she was in Vegas too. She had driven down here with a carload of gear to join you in this fight. So 16 hours she drove. So what we are seeing here is a combined arms effort. We have the people. We have their elected representatives who are standing up across the West. We did have some good sheriffs here the other day. Sheriff Mack is forming a coalition of sheriffs to stand with you. We know this fight's not over, so we're going to have a coalition effort across the entire West of the oath-keeping legislators and sheriffs and governors with the people behind them, and especially the veterans behind them, in honor of our oaths, we must support them. You cannot demand that your legislators who took that oath honor their oath by defending you. You cannot demand the sheriff stand up if you are not willing to stand behind them as the posse. Just like we saw here this last weekend. The people stood up. The founders told us in their wisdom that we must be the militia, right? It is necessary for the security of a free state. You will not be secure, you will not be free without it. It's time we resurrect that and become the militia once again. And this was a first step. It was a watershed moment. It reminds me of what happened in Washington, D.C. when the veterans stood up at the World War II Memorial and tore down those barricades and marched them to the White House and put them back, return to slander. And you saw what happened there, right? They brought out the riot police and lined them up in front of the fence. But what then would happen next? Then the riot police, when they had veterans in their face, they backed off. They backed off and they left because they weren't dealing with Occupy hippies. They were dealing with hardcore, red-blooded American veterans and patriots. And that's what I saw here on Saturday. You have a strong family here, and all the credit in the world goes to the Bundy family for taking a stand that others around here would not take. They've got neighbors who used to be cattlemen who were no longer cattlemen. Still cowboys. And then they cowboyed up with their friends and their family, and with your support, they took an important stand. And now it's incredibly important that we take that victory and take it and spread it around the West. What has to happen now is the rise of the West.
That was some audio from April 14, 2014, a press conference given by Stuart Rhodes, Oath Keepers leader, and in support of the Bundys and their fight in Bunkerville against the Buck, against the Bureau of Land Management. And you hear him describing basically what happened on at the Capitol insurrection on January 6, 2021, some 7 years later. And talking about the rise of the militia, right? And a coalition of legislators, oath-keeping legislators and sheriffs and governors with the people behind them and veterans. And that is really what we're seeing in our national politics today. He describes an event at the Washington D.C. where veterans stood up at the World War II Memorial, and that the riot police backed down because they weren't quote dealing with Occupy hippies, and they were dealing with hardcore red-blooded Americans and patriots. So and he gives the credit to the Bundy family for taking a stand, and so you can see the direct ties there, and that's why I thought it was important to play that audio. And I apologize that the first few minutes were not great. But it's important to really make that connection between what was happening in 2014 and what is happening now, and even in the 2022 elections. I had another audio planned. I'm going to try to play it. I hopefully won't run to the end of the time. We're kind of running short on time here. But in January 13, 2022, at the beginning of this year, their seditious conspiracy charges were issued against the Oath Keepers. I think 11 members, including Stuart Rhodes. And so let's listen to this bit of a snippet. It's more than a snippet. I apologize. It's really, she lays out. Joy Reid on the readout lays out quite well what happened and sort of the level of violence and the real danger this poses. So let's listen to the audio of the readout January 2022 show.
Cheers. Good evening, everyone. We begin the readout tonight with a major escalation in the January 6th investigation. For the first time, the Department of Justice has filed seditious conspiracy charges related to the insurrection, charging 11 people, including the leader of the far-right militia, the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes. Now, seditious conspiracy is defined as if two or more persons conspire to overthrow, put down, or destroy by force the government, or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law, or by force to seize, take, or possess any property. Now, in plain English, this is the first time our government has called some of the events that happened on January 6th a conspiracy to use force to prevent the presidential transition. It's important to understand who we're dealing with here. Now, unlike the randomly thuggish Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers are an organization largely of current and former military, law enforcement, and first responders. They're armed, and they're trained by our own tax dollars to know how to use those weapons. In their statement announcing the indictment, the DOJ alleges that Rhodes and his co-defendants conspired by organizing into teams that were prepared and willing to use force and to transport firearms and ammunition into Washington, D.C., recruiting members, organizing trainings to teach and learn paramilitary combat tactics, and bringing and contributing paramilitary gear. They're also accused of breaching and attempting to take control of the Capitol grounds and building, using force against law enforcement officers, and plotting to, and continuing to plot after January 6th to oppose by force the lawful transfer of power. The indictment also provides a timeline of the encrypted group chat messages that Rhodes sent encouraging his co-conspirators. 2 days after the election, November 5th, Rhodes urged his followers to refuse to accept the election result and states, quote, "We aren't getting through this without a civil war," unquote. On November 7th, he said, "We must now do what the people of Serbia did when Milosevic stole the election, refused to accept it, and march en masse on the nation's capital." And by November 9th, he held a call outlining a plan to stop the lawful transfer of power. The organizing and the paramilitary training continued over the next few months, with Rhodes advocating for the use of force on the Oath Keepers website. On Christmas Day, 6 days after Trump's Be in D.C., It Will Be Wild tweet, Rhodes wrote, "I think Congress will screw President Trump over. The only chance we have is if we scare the S out of them and convince them it will be torches and pitchforks time if they don't do the right thing. But I don't think they will listen." The planning continued, and by January 5th, they were in the D.C. area, stocked with weapons. On the morning of January 6th, they split into two so-called stacks, one on each side of the Capitol. At around 2:12 p.m., Rhodes entered the restricted Capitol grounds. At 2:25, he instructed his co-conspirators, "Come to south side of the Capitol." And, as the DOJ notes, at approximately 2:30 p.m., Oath Keepers and affiliates, many wearing paramilitary clothing and patches with the Oath Keepers name, logo, and insignia, marched in a stack formation up the east steps of the Capitol, joined a mob, and made their way into the Capitol. And we all know what happened next. An insurrection ensued. Rhodes was arrested today and is currently an inmate in Collin County, Texas. The Oath Keepers are one of two major violent groups accused of orchestrating the insurrection, along with the Proud Boys, you know, the group that Trump told to stand back and stand by during the presidential debates. The January 6th Select Committee is investigating both of these groups, but Rhodes hasn't decided yet whether he will testify. Joining me now, Joyce Vance, former U.S. attorney and MSNBC counterterrorism and intelligence analyst Malcolm Nance, whose new book, They Want to Kill Americans, The Militias, Terrorists, and Deranged Ideology of the Trump Insurgency, is due out in July. Joyce, I'm going to start with you. What is the significance of the Department of Justice going with a seditious conspiracy charge?
So selecting this charge is really DOJ framing the issues around January 6th. And Joy, as you noted, this indictment is careful to set forth that they're looking not just at that day itself, but at what preceded it and what followed it. So they're looking at a conspiracy and ongoing course of conduct. And unlike prior indictments, this is not an indictment that alleges obstruction of Congress. This is not an indictment that talks about being on the Capitol grounds without permission. This sets forth a seditious conspiracy, an effort to interfere with the transfer of power. And it brings new gravitas to the way that DOJ is viewing these events, confirming that they're going after the heart of a conspiracy to take down democracy.
You know, Malcolm Nance, what stood out to me in reading through this indictment was the way that the leader of the Proud Boys was referencing Milosevic, referencing what Serbians did to try to overthrow that, you know, him taking power, stealing the elections. And also, if you look at what they had, I mean, these are just some of the weaponry and tactics that were discussed on these group chats. They brought shotguns and scopes, magazines, sights, optics, AR platforms, rifles, firearms, night vision devices, a boat that could handle a Potomac crossing. They said we could have our team with the heavy weapons standing by quickly load them and ferry them across the river. This was not a casual conspiracy. It sounds like an active military plan.
It was an active military plan, and believe me, I've been monitoring the internal communications of these groups since this time last year, well before the insurrection. And, you know, when I wrote my last book on this, one of the things that I found very, very early on, what it wasn't just the Oath Keepers that were planning to be seditious. You're going to find out further in subsequent indictments, I'm certain. The Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and the 3% militias had multiple meetings about this. They started and really started getting people ready in late October, early November, sending them to training schools, having them, you know, have 1,500, you know, 150 rounds of combat load ammunition on their weapons, getting their body armor together. What you saw on January 6th was the command cell of the Oath Keepers. There were many, many, many hundreds more Oath Keepers there. It's a big organization. It's just that this was Stuart Rhodes' teams that he was bringing into the building. And if you recall that very night, we were on this very program, I said it's quite possible that these people may have had capture and kill teams that were organized to go in there. Murder cells is another way that we put them, and that they would be very well organized. This entire sedition was, you know, the insurrection in itself was well organized, because not only did they plan it, they also sent orders out to everyone, and thousands of people came dressed like them.
So there you heard on the readouts from January of this year, when suspicious conspiracy charges were issued by the government and against the Oath Keepers. And I felt it was really important. I get the sort of the details of the armed assault, which are really shocking. And I'm sure this is not just a spontaneous sort of event. There was a lot of planning went into this training, and they even have boats available to ferry heavy weaponry over across the Potomac. I mean, it's extraordinary. And I was going to close with another audio, but I'm just going to actually read out some of it from Jason Van Totenhove's his testimony. And he basically said that we were lucky that more bloodshed did not happen. He says, I think we've gotten exceedingly lucky that more bloodshed did not happen, because the potential has been there from the start. And we got very lucky. The loss of life was, and as tragic as it is, that we saw on January 6th, the potential was so much more. Again, all we have to look at is the iconic images of that day with the gallows set up for Mike Pence for the President of the United States. And he goes on to say, you know, for this next election cycle, because who knows what that might bring. It's a president that's willing to try to instill and encourage to whip up a civil war amongst his followers, using lies and deceit and snake oil, and regardless of the human impact, what else is he going to do? If he gets elected again, all bets are off at that point. And so, I don't know. It's extraordinary. I mean, even though I've been following this for, I guess, since I've been writing about it since 2014, 8 years now, I still find it astounding that we are at this point, right? And yet it's you still have so many Americans, and I would have to say they are mostly white Americans, voting for Trump, you know. And it's getting back to that that poll that came out, and I think it was from Nate Silver and his outfit there, 538. Looking at that poll, one of the things I heard him being interviewed on NPR about it, or actually in the New York Times podcast, The Daily, and I found it very frustrating. I've actually had personal when I did a lot of reporting on the Redskins, and particularly when the Washington Post did a poll to find that the Redskins was not offensive, right? I did a piece in the Nation magazine about that, and Nate Silver sort of attacked me, and so there was some personal beef there. But I do question some of the findings of the polling, because a lot of the polling But I think that I will probably do more of a deep dive into polling issues and stuff. I'm scared. I am also scared about what's going to happen during the elections and what could happen. And I think the next show I'll go into much more structural detail of why this is so and what the issues are. But thank you all for listening. This has been American Standoff. I'm Jacqueline Keeler, your host. Thank you to our caller. I really appreciate the discussion. And I think that would be a great show in of itself, looking at the dollar and other aspects. And I look forward to talking to you all next week. Thank you.